Welcome to the collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
Put the finger roll! Plus the foul!
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day, or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. Usually this is when I say this is Etan Thomas, 10-year NBA player, Chuck Modiano, the man of the streets of Washington, D.C., but both those fellas are out for very good reasons, but I will keep their privacy to themselves, but I will also vouch for the fact that these are very good reasons. So who comes in? I got to get somebody who's not a former NBA player. I got to get somebody who's more comfortable on the couch than the streets, but I also got to get somebody who is literally one of the smartest cats I know, especially during NCAA time. How could I be joined by anybody but the coach, Kevin McNutt? Coach, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, brother. I'm doing well.
Look, excellent. You feeling good this time of year?
Oh, always. This is my time of year. You know it, Dave. You know, yours is coming. The NBA playoffs is around the corner. So, you know. So,
well, I have some real questions for you about the very philosophy of today's NCAA, and we're going to use Maryland to talk about that for sure.
Okay.
But first, I have to say something. I have to do a little community service announcement for everybody. I got to get serious before we have some fun.
Yes,
because
sir.
Unfortunately, and Coach, I'll bring you in after this, but Coach, these are serious times. There's a lot of mess up happening in this world. There's a lot of mess up happening in this country. And there's a lot of mess up happening in Washington, D.C. right now, due to the federal government, due to the Elon Musk, Donald Trump administration. And I want to be able to let the folks know about something that happened yesterday, so folks can prepare themselves. So yesterday morning, if you have not heard, a mix of masked and unmasked ICE officers, I guess you would call them, attempted to arrest the school nurse at Cook Elementary School. And if you don't know Cook, it's located in the densely populated Adams Morgan section of Washington, D.C. Now, workers at the school intervened, demanding a warrant, holding up their phones, and ICE ran off without making their arrest because you had this growing angry group of workers and parents looking at them, having their phones up. And ICE, you know, that was a humiliation from them. They issued a statement afterwards that they weren't actually there to detain anybody. But this is contradicted by videos, witnesses, and a statement even by DCPS headquarters, the DC Public Schools. Now, since then, in Adams Morgan, and I think everybody's familiar with the neighborhood of Adams Morgan, for goodness sakes, there was a march, there was a community meeting. This all happened yesterday. But the school workers, the parents, the kids, they're really shook by this. Now, entering schools right now by ICE, we have to say it is beginning. Cook is not the only story right now where this is happening. And I'm not talking about DC, I'm talking about nationally. But it has yet to take root as a regular practice. And so we need to, if you haven't done it yet, I'm talking to any parents, any teachers, any school workers out there, you need a plan as to what to do when ICE comes calling. You need to contact, first of all, your union to see if they have a plan. And frankly, not all unions do have a plan. I've talked to people in five different cities. But schools need to have their own plans, independent of the union, independent of downtown. In this case, independent of DC Public Schools. Now, a school plan means that everybody can have a different role, whether it's to alert colleagues, whether it's to take video, whether it's to call attorneys, whether it's to alert a parent network, whether it's to call the union, and in this case, as we just heard, whether it's to demand warrants. Nothing that I just said is against the law. They are all things you can do to make sure your school is safe. I can't believe I need to have this conversation because as someone from a family of teachers, my goodness, teaching in the public school system is hard enough without having to worry about such a thing. Just educating kids is hard enough without having to worry about such a thing. Maintaining basic school discipline so students can learn is difficult enough without having to deal with such a thing. But deal with it we must. You know, people in generations past had to deal with similar, if not worse, things. We're not special. This is our turn. We need to accept that. All right, that's all I had to say, Mr. Coach.
Yeah, man, well done, well spoken. You are a soldier on the streets. I mean, we heard about the Tufts University young lady, but this one was, you know, sort of under the radar unless you hear in the local community. So thank you, Dave.
Yeah, of course. You're referring to the young woman in Somerville, Massachusetts, who was taken off the streets there. And then there was a demonstration of several thousand people protesting her abduction. I mean, that's some scary stuff right there, because a court, like said, you can't take this young woman out of Massachusetts. And before you knew it, she's in Louisiana. Well, actually, no one knew where she was. And then they found out she was in Louisiana. I mean, scary times, man. We've got that slave labor camp in El Salvador that they're sending people to, not caring if they're innocent or guilty. I mean, you know, I'm somebody who's always been a critic of the United States because I want it to be better. And this is a United States I've never seen in my lifetime. So this is what we're dealing with. Such is life. We got to keep pushing on. And frankly, I also strongly believe that if we have all of these injustices become our solo mindset, we will eventually also dry out in a husk and not be able to live our lives and also not be there for the next battle. And so it's so important also that we recognize things that do allow our minds to go at ease for a moment. And it's important for us to recognize and respect when elders pass on, and so we can respect who they were, what they brought to the conversation, and lift up their memory in a way that uplifts ourselves. And I say all that, Coach, because we lost a giant, a literal giant, over the last couple of weeks. Somebody who, last week to be particular, somebody who meant a great deal to me for one conversation we once had over 2 hours. And I'm talking about the former two-time heavyweight champion of the world, Big George Foreman, 1968 gold medal winner when he was just 19 years old, was the most fearsome fighter of his time. And then had a comeback, the likes of which has never been duplicated, and I think will never be replicated in the history of sports. A comeback that wasn't just about coming back to the ring, but also changing his entire personality, or I should say showing us his true personality and becoming beloved in a way he never was as a young fighter. Coach, when I say the words George Foreman, when I speak about him passing, what comes to your mind, please?
First of all, man, I got to compliment you, my brother. You are a pro's pro. I mean, the way you blended that transition was excellent, man.
Oh, thank you. An unexpected compliment from a man who insults me constantly. Please continue, Coach.
What were you doing, Dave? Okay. So it's really hard for me to put butter on you, but I got to give you props for that, man. That was excellent, soldier. Excellent, excellent. George Foreman, back in the 70s, you know, we were all Ali boys. We loved Ali, all things Ali. We were scared of George Foreman and the fighting Zaire in 74. George Foreman was a bad dude. Come out of, you know, out of the streets of Houston, and he was a brawler. Like, he's the one that was bullied. You say, oh, yeah, you move to the neighborhood. Take on the bully. Take on the baddest cat in the bully. No, you wouldn't want to take on no George Foreman. He was a bad cat. I mean, heading down a bad path. And then he found his way to the ring and encouragement. And then the rest is history about, you know, the amateur fighter. Eventually go into the Olympics, as you mentioned. But we were scared to death in Zaire. Well, yeah, we knew about Liston. But, you know, we saw Ali fight Liston. Ali wasn't giving away a lot. Ali was a big, people don't understand that Ali was a big man.
Mm-hmm.
A different character. And, the comparison with Foreman and Liston, yeah, okay, some of that, you know, backgrounds and all of that stuff, but a devastating puncher. So we were scared. And Ali was talking the talk, and we're going to buy it. We're going to live it to the end. We were scared to death in 74 for Ali, our hero. Ali says, it was quiet as a church mouse in his locker room before going out to fight Foreman. And he just said, hey, what's wrong with you guys? What is this? Let's go, we're gonna do this thing. But we were always, I remember Cosell, who loved Ali. They were, you know, one and two. And saying, I'm worried about the champ. I don't think he can do it. I mean, you can feel the fear in Cosell. And you remember this, when you saw Foreman, all you can remember is Cosell saying when he fought Frazier, down goes Frazier. Down goes Frazier. Down goes Frazier. It was a 6 knockdown. And so we were scared to death for Ali. Safety, the loss, the whole 9 yards. Foreman lost, and man, he became a recluse. He really was devastated. He didn't think he could lose.
Mm-hmm.
And he really transformed his life to where he was, I mean, you call Cosby the father or whatever, but Foreman was the granddaddy, the big old cuddly teddy bear, the way he turned his life around. Preacher, Foreman Grill, the commercials. I know he came back to boxing, but the way he came and just turned his life around in so many ways to be a lovable cat from where he was headed coming out of the streets of Houston. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing story. And I want to hear this story that you have to have with your conversation with him.
Well, I will, but first a couple of thoughts on Foreman. That you made a great point, and I want to just expand on a couple of them. First and foremost for Ali, and that's that styles make fights.
Yes, sir.
And so what Cosell was doing, and I'm not saying Cosell was alone. As you said, this fear was across. Who grew to love Muhammad Ali because of his opposition to the war in Vietnam. Which by this time in 74, the country had overwhelmingly turned against. You know, he had already become somebody who people respected. And I think he earned actually more respect by losing to Joe Frazier in Madison Square Garden in 1970 than he gained by winning the titles against Liston in the 60s, you know, and being undefeated. I mean, it made people love him, to see him lose. It's an incredible thing when you mm-hmm. go back and look at that. Mm-hmm. And then, so here's Frazier, knocks down the unbreakable Ali, wins the fight. And then, as you said, gets utterly destroyed by George Foreman in epic fashion. Down goes Frazier, becomes a part of American history as a three-word phrase, for goodness sakes.
Yes, sir.
For goodness sakes. And George Foreman, this is the other part, too. One of the Ali List, when Ali beat Sonny Liston in 1964 for the title, something the commentators said was, whoa, we didn't realize how big Ali was. You know, he's taller than Liston. He's broad-shouldered like Liston. Maybe not as broad-shouldered, but goodness gracious. Like, why did we think this was going to build this as like a pipsqueak versus a monster? But then against Foreman, good gracious. You know, Foreman actually was who people thought Sonny Liston was. And that made him terrifying. But I think people ignored, and Cosell ignored, that the styles make the fights. And Ali did have a way, you know, we call it the rope-a-dope, but, you know, it wasn't just the rope-a-dope against Foreman. He was doing his jab and move, too. Everybody knows, like, if you saw the movie When We Were Kings, they do a great job of showing this. Ali starting the fight with a right-handed jab from a right-handed fighter. And the right-handed jab is just considered the most insulting punch if you're a right-handed fighter. It's your way of saying, I'm punching from way back, and you still can't stop it. That's how fast I am. And that started the great frustration of George Foreman, which is really why he lost that fight, was the profound frustration he felt as it went on. Now, I just wanted to say that. Now, but there are a couple of interesting things about Foreman that I want to say, that it's so interesting to me that Ali, in the lead up to the fight in Zaire, never really was cruel to George Foreman, beyond saying he looked like a mummy, which was kind of funny because of how Foreman moved. And Foreman, people won't believe this if they only know the older George Foreman, but his face was like this expressionless mask. He didn't really talk to the press, and Ali just made fun of that. But he never took it to that personal bone level like he took it to Frazier. And that's a whole separate conversation of what it was in Joe Frazier that made Ali so mad. Maybe we could talk about that another time, but I don't want to take the focus off of Big George. So, as you said so well, George Foreman recreates himself. First did get in the public eye as a preacher. Like, whoa, the puncher became a preacher. Then he gets notoriety because he comes back to the ring and just looks so different. The bald head, the Buddha stomach. This was not the George Foreman who was last in the public eye. So that was a big shock to people. And then the shock that even though he couldn't really move in the ring, ooh, did he still pack a punch. Knocked out Michael Moore with one punch and actually wins a title, something nobody thought he can do. And believe me, Michael Moore was a scary man. But, you know, sometimes it just takes that one punch on the button. Some people said that fight was fixed. I watched that fight in real time. Trust me, Michael Moore was on Doozy Street, if you catch my drift. So, the other part about George Foreman, and this will lead into my little story here, is that in the 1968 Olympics, when he was 19 years old, after he dominated and won the gold, he grabbed a little American flag and bowed to each side of the ring. This happened just a few days after Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists on the medal stand, and as a result were kicked out of Olympic Village, were vilified by the press, and just got on a plane and went home with their families who were there. After a series of bad confrontations with the IOC, all sorts of terribleness. And then George Foreman waves that flag, and it was read as Foreman rebuking Smith and Carlos, yep. Saying basically, they're un-American, I am American, they don't appreciate America, I do. I'm the, you know, for lack of a better phrase, because this is really how it was put, I'm the good one, they're the bad ones. That kind of good-bad trope, which back then was just catnip for the media.
Hey, you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
He was called in the hood, Uncle Tom. for doing that flag, because exactly right. We saw this upstaging John Carlos and Tommy Smith. So it was like, oh, you Uncle Tom, you the dude. We know exactly what you're doing. We know exactly why you're doing this. So go ahead. I just wanted to throw that in.
No, that's important because, as we'll hear, George Foreman certainly knew that that's what he had been called in 68, certainly. And was one of the reasons why people were all in for Ali and Zaire, too. Because they were like, Ali is righteous. What Foreman did was not righteous. But the interesting thing was, when I was just a young pup starting out, Coach, before you and I even knew each other, if it's even possible there was such a time, I did my first ever big sports interview. It was with Dr. John Carlos. It was the first one I ever did.
Yes, sir. No, go ahead.
I asked him about George Foreman, get his comments. He said, I loved Big George. Big George was great. He wasn't trying to rebuke us. He was our guy. I hate the way that's part of the history. Then my second big sports interview was with another Olympic rebel from 1968, the late, great Lee Evans, record setter in the 400 meters.
Right.
And Lee Evans said the same thing about George Foreman. I never saw it as a rebuke. I love Big George. That's my brother. I hate that that's part of the history. So I figure, gee whiz, the person I really got to talk to now is George Foreman. But I'm just this young reporter, Coach. I don't know how to get through to any George Foreman. Are you kidding me? How would I do that? So what I did was, I had no other way to think about how to do it. This is in the early days of like the internet and Google. And nowadays you could just type in so-and-so's publicist and a number will come up. Back then there just wasn't any of that. So what I did was I Googled, although it was a different search engine, it was called Ask Jeeves. I put into Ask Jeeves, how do I contact George Foreman? And the only thing that came up was the website for the George Foreman Grill. So isn't that something? This is the only thing that came up. So I said, heck with it. Why not? So I call myself, I go to the George Foreman Grill and I click on the link where it's like, contact us if you have any problems with your grill. And I typed in there, hey, I'm a reporter. My grill is fine. I'd love to interview George Foreman about 1968. Within, Coach, 10 minutes, under 10 minutes, I got an email back and it said, this is George, here's my cell, give me a call.
Isn't that fascinating? Go ahead, you got us now. Continue, my brother.
To this day, Coach.
I hear you.
I don't know what happened there. Was he like on the hotline? Was he helping out with people's grills? What happened? I mean, If I try to imagine, the most likely thing that happened is someone got that and knew George and forwarded to him, and he was like, oh, I'll talk about 68. That's probably what happened. But even that, you remember, maybe our young listeners don't know, you remember how big the George Foreman Grill was.
Absolutely.
This was an international phenomenon.
Yes.
Allowed you to grill your sandwiches without grease. I mean, that was revolutionary. And so it's just crazy to me that within 10 minutes I get that email. So I call George Foreman, you know, and my palms are sweating, you know, I'm like, and half of me wonders if I'm being pranked. So I call him up and I don't want to go on too long about it, but, you know, I wanted to just, you know, warm him up a little bit. Didn't want to be like, why did you do that in 1968? Partly because I was so honored to talk to him.
Right.
So I was just like, sir, you know, and I'm a new pup too. So I'm like, sir, what was it like to grow up in Houston? And man, he told a story of like poverty. Like people who are poor would look at George Foreman and how grew up and be like, wow, you were really poor. You know, in the poorest area of Houston, you know, didn't have 20, as he said, 23 cents was what, you know, school lunch costs. We did not know what 23 cents looked like. So we were just hungry all the time. And I asked him, I was like, well, you know, how did you get out of that? Was it boxing? And he said to me, no, I actually, and this is important, coach, because today we don't have programs like this the way we used to. He said he joined what was called the Job Corps, where young people could learn like hard work and make a little scratch. You know, it wasn't some for-profit enterprise. It was a way to actually reach young people. You know, give them, put a hand out to give them hope. But they would have to put up their hand too and put in some hard work. So, you know, I was like, wow. So that's what did it for you. And he goes, yeah, yeah, and that plus the boxing. And I said to him, okay, you're in the Job Corps. Well, when did you first learn that there was this thing happening called the Black Freedom Struggle in the 60s? Was it a conversation on the streets of Houston? And he said, no, I learned about it from this Anglo-Saxon dude, which was his way of saying white dude. He said, he basically said, I learned about the Black Freedom Struggle from a white dude from Tacoma, Washington, who was there in the Job Corps, like supervising and helping us, you know, get acclimated to what we were supposed to do. That's how he learned about the Black Freedom Struggle, from a white dude from Tacoma, Washington, who gave him a record. And I thought, well, what's the record? And he said, Bob Dylan. I was like, Bob Dylan? And he said, yeah, and I heard a song that just opened up my mind and wanted me to learn more. And I thought he was going to say, like, the times, they are changing. You know what I'm saying? Like one of the famous ones. And I know that's your favorite song, Coach. Yeah. And but the song that got him going was a song people might not know. And it's a song called it's called Rainy Day Women number 12 and 35.
What?
That's the name of the song he loved. It was called Rainy Day Women number 12 and 35. And it's the first track from the 1965 album Blonde on Blonde. And he said, do you know that one? And I wasn't the biggest Dylan fan. I have become one. And I was like, I said, well, I don't know that song. What is that song? And he said, I'll sing it for you. Now, at this point, coach, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I was like, this, he's kidding, right? Is George Foreman about to sing Bob Dylan to me over the phone? Sure enough, in a voice so beautiful, man. This was, you could tell he'd been in the church, is all I have to say. It was a choral voice, which you would not expect to come from big George Foreman. And he sang this, and people might know this song. He said, well, they'll stone you when you're walking along the street. You know this one, Coach?
No.
They'll stone you when you're trying to keep your seat. And then it ends by going, everybody must get stoned, is how it ends. And he said all that, and I assumed it was like, of course, a drug reference of some kind, everybody must get stoned. And he said that he heard that song, and it made him think of Jesus as somebody who was able to withstand the hate and oppression of others and emerge unscathed. And it made him look much harder at, you know, the whispers in Houston about, you know, Dr. King and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and everything that was happening in the 60s. Like, it just put his mind in a different place. And I just thought that was an amazing story, man. And the other thing that was amazing, just real quick, is I asked him about his thoughts about Cassius Clay when he changed his name to Muhammad Ali. And he said it terrified people in his Houston neighborhood that people were calling Ali a black Muslim. And I said to him, oh, because people didn't know what Muslim was about? Was that what scared them? And he said, no, that didn't matter to us. What mattered to us was that people were calling him black. You know, we saw ourselves as Negroes, and now he's calling himself black.
Yes.
And I thought that was an interesting perspective that I'd never heard before.
I've said this to you before on the show, Dave, and when we're talking about the impact of Ali. Ali gave us, baby boomers of that time and era, a sense and a pride of being called black that we just didn't know. And I give you this, in 76, 77, when Reggie Jackson, no shrinking violet by any means and would take on anybody, including this country and its thoughts. He said that. Mr. October said that, I never knew what it was to be black and proud until I heard Ali saying it. That's Reggie Jackson. So that's the impact of Ali. That's why he's my favorite athlete of all time and will never change. He gave that to a young teenage boy named Kevin McNutt and his associates, you know, life and pride. It was one of his quotes. And again, I know you're paying tribute to George here, but you got me on a tangent. Because Ali would say, I'm the greatest of all times. I could be any man alive. And I'm pretty as a girl. I mean, you know, the pride that he gives you, because he can do both. He was, could be any man alive and did. And he was a strikingly handsome man and could rap and rhyme. And with the best of them, his classic interviews were with Cosell and Wide World of Sports. They were classics anyway. You got me started on that one, but go ahead.
No, I just want, that was beautiful. I just want to put one button on the story, and then we will go to break, and then we're going to come back and talk some NCAAs. But this is the most important part of this whole story, was I then did ask him about 1968 and why he waved that flag. And he said that he did it not, he said it had nothing to do with Tommy Smith and John Carlos. He said two things that I think have been written out of the history books. First, he said that when Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Lee Evans would walk through the Olympic Village, they were the rock stars of the Olympic Village, not just because of their politics, although their politics were a part of it for sure, but also because of the incredible esteem that track and field was held in the black community. Mm-hmm. Like, track and field was a huge deal. The legacy of Jesse Owens, the legacy of Ralph Boston, you know, that was real for people, not to mention Wilma Rudolph and her amazingness, Wyoming Attias and her amazingness. And so they were the rock stars. And to Foreman, they were like big brothers to him. And when they left Mexico City, he said he almost left too, gave up his chance of the gold. And almost left too. I think that's an amazing thing to say. Yep. But then with the flag, it was one of those things where he just was thinking about like how hungry he was growing up and grateful that he got the gold. People are cheering for him. No one's ever cheered for him in his life. And he had this little American flag, which they had given to all the athletes. And he just started waving it to say thank you. And it's like, I think at worst, you can say that this 19-year-old kid, and I think it's a pretty hard thing to throw on a 19-year-old kid winning a gold medal at the Olympics, but at worst, he was naive about how such an action would be received in the context of Smith and Carlos raising their fists. So naive about that. But at the same time, he's not Malcolm X, you know?
Right.
19-year-old kid, you know?
I got you.
So I think, you know, that's such an important part of the story. And, you know, and then the last thing I'll say about it before we go to break is that, you know, I was on the phone with John Carlos after Foreman passed, and John at the time, I hope he's found it, I'll find from him, was trying to find out where the services would be, because he really wanted to be there to show the world that the history that they've been told is not the history as it was. So, that being said, let's go to break right now. We're going to come back and hand this over to Coach. We're going to find out if UMD has a chance to go all the way, in addition to other NCAA men's tournament news and a word about Juju Watkins from the NCAA women's tournament and what her injury means to women's college basketball right now. I have thoughts about that myself. We're going to go to break right after this. We're going to be back right after this. Excuse me. We are The Collision, 89.3 FM, trying to change this world and this city, one broadcast at a time.
Time to get funky and radical hip as I get to the point. Rock this funky joint. Wait a sec. The teacher's got to check the intellect, but some accepting didn't give you it. But give you what? The beaver or the chief, I often come to test it up. But
stand for this. For this, why civilized it? Hip hot rhyme from a black mind. To kicking it to you all the time. I salam, you like a more a peace sign. Represent my way of life and must be that of Islam. I take my time, think before I manifest the rhyme. Sharp and accurate to stop the music on a dime. Knowledge me, acapella, wisdom G. I'm manifesting, understanding, understood. So there's no need for I keep you guessing. Follow me now, see? See, I be rocking. The second hand is ticking, still the posse don't be clocking. Controllers of the clock be ticking closer to the point. Rock this funky joint.
We are back here on The Collision. I'm here with Kevin McNutt. I'm Dave Zirin. I don't have to ask Mike this one. I know that's Poor Righteous Teachers with the Holy Intellect, PRT, group I listened to often growing up. We'll take it to you, Kevin McNutt. Kevin McNutt, how have you felt about the NCAA tournament, the men's tournament thus far? Meeting expectations for you? I know you get into it every year. Not meeting expectations. A lot of talk about how there are no Cinderellas in the Sweet 16 for the first time, and they're blaming NIL. What name, image, and likeness money they can pay at the big schools. What's your general thought on the contours of everything? Are you having a good time? What do you think?
I'm not going to answer that question because I know we have a little script production meeting, but I want to do this. I want to talk about Juju because that's a sad story.
Yes, yes.
Even on a high note of the NCAA tournament, which I'm enjoying immensely. Let's talk about Juju here because it is a sad story. It's going to be a happy ending, but at this particular moment, it's a sad story.
Juju Watkins, of course, the star that's now the commercial star of the NCAA women's basketball world. Mm-hmm. And her tearing an ACL at a tournament that I think USC was primed to win. Mm-hmm. And also primed to be a Juju Watkins coming out for the broader world. You know, the way Caitlin Clark broke through and was beyond just a basketball story. I think Juju really does have that potential in every way. And that she couldn't exercise that at this tournament is a bummer. It stinks, quite frankly. Imagine if Caitlin Clark had gotten hurt like early in last year's tournament. It would have been a bummer, a big bummer. And it is in here, this case too.
Here's the positive. One of Juju's first calls should be to Paige Buckets and Dukers at UConn, because Paige has suffered all sorts of knee injuries, including an ACL. And she has rebounded, she has rebounded time and time again to where she's back All-America status. Her team is in contention to make a serious run toward the title, and she's heading for WNBA stardom. And Juju's going to be the same place. She's just a sophomore. She's going to come back. However, the timing could not be the worst right now here in March, not only for the tournament's sake, for her recovery, summer shot, rehab. She may be back in the end, the second half of next season, but probably not to the Juju we know and expect her to rise to the following season. She will get back. She will be the star, and she's got, like you said, everything going for her. She's beautiful, charismatic, smile, personality, and game. So she's gonna be okay. It's just gonna be a tough haul, and we're gonna miss her in the intern. And in USC, they're not gonna go far. They're not gonna go far without.
No, I don't think so either. I could talk about Juju all day. I saw her play at UMD earlier this year, the excitement, the crowd she brought to the game. I mean, it is that kind of thing that you wait for. You know, if you're a college basketball, men's or women's, that sort of person who grasps a broader imagination, that sort of person who's already been there a year so people know who she is and not learning about her on the fly, like, say, Cooper Flagg with Duke. It's not good. But as you said, the comeback will be real, and it'll be all the sweeter when it does happen. And I'll just say this too, Coach. I met a very prominent women's softball player from the, like, early mid-70s, right? Her career ended with a torn ACL. She had a scar on her leg that you would not believe, like a zipper, in order to cure that torn ACL. The technology has changed so much.
There you go.
The medical science has changed so much. People don't even realize that used to be an athletic death sentence. particularly for women. And it's no longer, or it would change you for life, you know, like my man Bernard King, you know, one of the all-time greats, change your game for life. That's just not the way it is anymore.
No. And that's why I'm so optimistic for it. You know, you say that, the one that comes to my mind, and again, about older than you, is Gale Sayers. I mean, who didn't love Gale Sayers? He was poetry in motion. And then he tore his knee out against San Francisco out in, Caesar Stadium. I might be wrong there. And his career was never the same. He 5 years, but he still went HOF. We didn't even need to speak about the technology and the comeback that you can with technology. From ACL. So, okay. So now can we move on to?
To
NCAA, we're running out of time here.
Yeah, let's go to the number one thing. There's so many stories. There's so many games tonight. You said you're having a good time. I want to know if you're vexed, first and foremost, if you're upset by the fact that there are no mid-majors, or I should say Cinderella-style teams in the Sweet 16.
Yes, of course. That's what makes the first 2 weeks. But Cinderella strikes midnight right about now. The Cinderellas. Again, we've had Loyola a couple years ago, NC State, but NC State's an ACC team. I'm talking about small mid-majors, like Loyola Chicago was a couple years ago, my George Mason before that. Mm. But generally, Cinderella's strike midnight around the Sweet 16, because that's when the big boys take over. What I'm scared of, Dave, is that with NIL, and I mentioned this last week, we may be seeing the death of Cinderella's here, because you never could compete to get the Cooper Flags of the day. Now you can't get the second tier players either, because here's what happened. I'm not having success at a Big Five school. Maybe I need to drop down and go to Mount St. Mary's, go to High Point University. Some of those Cinderella's we're talking about. Well, now you can instead go to, Seton Hall, not necessarily Seton Hall, but some other school like that, and say instead of getting $20,000 because they don't have the NIL money at NC Wilmington or High Point, you say, I'll go over here to a smaller school, but they're paying me $60,000-$80,000. So I'm not, you know what I'm saying? So that guy that can come down and drop down, say, okay, I didn't make it at Duke, but I can make it at Wilmington or James Madison, or George Mason, well, instead he goes to a second tier school that's paying him more. The money's there, the money talks, money walks. So I'm fearful of that. But staying on this tournament, I still love it. It's still March Madness, the games are great. Maryland's buzzer beater was fabulous, and there's more to come. And on the flip side of that, where's a matchup that you can say that I'm not interested in watching of all the eight games that are coming up here Thursday and Friday, tonight and tomorrow?
Well, that is sort of the flip side of this, because the Cinderella aspect of March Madness, and I hear you about the NIL and I hear you about the transfer portal. I think both things, I believe in both things from an issue of fairness. I also think there needs to be some kind of regulation in a way that, and frankly, for coaches' contracts too, there needs to be regulation at a time where regulation does not exist in this world, or largely does not exist. All of that being said, the Cinderella situation, and you just said it, is frankly kind of a myth, because once you get to this weekend, Cinderellas go night-night and there's no Prince Charming in the morning. So, some Cinderellas won to get to the round of 32. Great. That happened. They didn't win to get to the round of 16. Well, guess what? One game difference from the way it usually is. So, let's just not get too, tears about this. Austin Peay was not, has no NCAA championships, even with Fly Williams. You remember their old slogan, "The fly is open, let's go Peay."
Of course I know.
I'm sorry, this is a family show. But let me put it right to you, Coach. Everybody's talking about Maryland. Everybody's talking about that incredible shot by Derek Queen. Maryland, which had lost so many games in the last moment this year, so many buzzer beaters on the heartbreaking end. And then here's Derek Queen with what I thought was an incredibly difficult shot, showing tremendous touch and showing why he's going to be a top NBA pick, I think, after just his freshman year. But does Maryland have a good shot at getting past number one seed Florida and maybe making a bigger run?
No. I'm in the DMV too. Maryland's, everybody knows, the F5, they are good, very good team. Florida is 10, 11 deep. They will rotate. They will put the players. They have four bigs. They have three guards, all headed for the pros, most likely, including their star, Clayton. Something's going to – it's hard to get through, in Maryland's case, with five guys being hand and glove fit for an entire tournament, even for an entire game at this level. So if Rice is off or if Reese gets in foul trouble, Maryland has no options. And something like that's going to happen. Perfect example, I'll go with our audience up in New York and you, Luis, for St. John's, three for 17. They were doomed. Coach Pitino put him on a bench for the last, 3.5 minutes of the game. So I'm not saying that, you know, I'm just saying that something can go wrong when you're only five deep. And if something goes wrong, you're 4-on-5 as it relates to Maryland because they don't have a bench. So, and Florida is the type team because they run fast, up-tempo, there's more possessions each way, something's bound to happen. Foul, trouble, just an off night.
Exhaustion.
That too. I mean, they're in great shape at this particular stage, but Florida's a different level. You want to go 90s? Let's do it.
That's what I'm saying. Like, exhaust. People don't understand. They're like, oh, well, it's just 40 minutes. They're young people. There's no such thing as exhaustion. But when Florida does that, as you said it, 94 feet back and forth for 40 minutes, try sprinting 94 feet back and forth for 40 minutes. You could be a marathon runner. You're going to be sucking wind.
You know, I think although in the tournament, you know, timeouts, TV timeouts for 2 minutes to 30, and a halftime goes from 15 minutes to a half hour, 20 to a half hour. But still, at that pace, when you get on there, man, it's worth mentioning, Dave. So, this is note.
All right, let's go to another game here that a lot of people have a lot of interest in, of course. Number one, Duke versus Arizona. Duke will probably have three players drafted in the top 10 this year. Some say even in the top seven. Three of the top seven. But Arizona, they're Charles Barkley's pick to go to the Final Four. Sometimes these freshman-heavy teams falter late in the tournament. We saw that with that great Kentucky undefeated squad with Karl-Anthony Towns. So things can happen. Arizona-Duke. Does Arizona have more of a puncher's chance than Maryland to knock off Duke as opposed to Maryland knocking off Florida?
Yes. Because Arizona, first of all, Caleb Love is his name. He's been there before, before transferring a couple of times. Well, he's not going to be starstruck with the environment, Sweet 16, or we're playing Duke. He's not afraid of Duke. And he's Arizona's best player. Arizona has several bigs. They have some other quick guards besides Love. Love is a Hyde and Jekyll kind of cat. He might go for 29 like he did his last game against Oregon, put the team on his shoulders, or he's susceptible to going 5 for 18 and the game's over. I still think Duke's going to prevail. And again, Duke, like you mentioned, has three freshmen starting. Now, Flag is all world, but he's still a freshman. Everybody gets tested in this game. Florida had a buzzer beater with Connecticut. Houston had a fight off Gonzaga, who had a last shot to tie. You are not going to get through this tournament, six games, with routing everybody by 20. So I think a scare is coming. It's going to be a great theater, but I think Duke's going to prevail because Arizona's just sometimes Arizona, the bright lights seems to hit Arizona more than some people. And I think Duke will win, I don't know, but 85-80, something like that.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, Cooper Flagg, he might not be capturing the nation's imagination from a ratings perspective, the way, let's say, Zion Williamson did and his great freshman season. You know, Zion was ratings gold. Cooper, less so. But I am so impressed by this young person. Clearly the number one pick in the NBA. Clearly, I hope my Washington Wizards get to draft him. I mean, my goodness, he reminds me a little bit of LeBron just from this perspective. Just from this perspective. I remember watching LeBron in high school and feeling like that's kind of a man playing with youth. You know, man, both in terms of shoulders and size and also savvy and intelligence. And I feel that way watching Cooper. Am I out of my mind? I know he's not the athlete that LeBron or the speed, but that sense of size and court awareness, he seems a little bit like the man playing with boys stereotype. What do you think about that?
Agree. LeBron never played college, so I'll throw that out. I know where you're going with this. Cooper, his intensity, that's what everybody you talk to, besides his ball skills, his high IQ, his size, they always say about his intensity, man, and go after it. And it's real. You can see it through the screen. I mean, this guy, he attacks the rim with pit bull steak. The rim is a steak, and he's a pit bull. I mean, he's on attack mode all 40 minutes. So yeah, he's the real deal. He's fun to watch, man.
I enjoy watching him very much, actually.
I'm surprised you said he's not moving the needle like Williamson did, because I mean, you could say the same thing about Caitlin. I mean, he's a great white hope, but I thought I discount that because he's the real deal.
I just heard a podcast about this, and okay. Yes, he's the real deal, and yes, he is a white person from the United States, and the great white U.S. player has not exactly emerged in recent years, unless you're just a huge Christian Braun fan. Christian Brown out of Denver.
Yeah, out of Denver, yeah.
Kansas. Yeah. Or if you think that Domas Sabonis, if you count him as American because he like went to high school in the United States, although when you're Arvydas Sabonis' son, that's a little tough for me. But the thing is that he's not moving the needle. Right. Maybe it's because of the Duke affiliation and Duke haters. I don't know. But Zion was ratings gold, and Cooper is not. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, we only have a little time left. Just real quick for tonight. Arkansas, Texas Tech.
Going upset, Arkansas. And I'm not a Calipari cat, so this is hard for me to say. But they seem to be on a roll. I'm not a Calipari cat. I'm a big chemistry guy. And they have chemistry. We talked about this all the way from your 11 and 12 that you coached on the weekends to my guys. I stress chemistry, man. You have got to get along. You have to got to see your brother, and he is your brother, and your brother's keeper. That goes you a long way. Arkansas has got 9-10 guys that are all in for it. You can see it every time out, the way they hug each other and clap and cheer for each other. That goes a long way. Maybe they overcome the shortcomings of Cal. I'm not a Cal guy, though. And I'm talking about John Calipari for those that.
I was going to say, what do you have against California? No, I'm just kidding. I knew what you meant.
No.
But I'll tell you this, Coach. For those people who are sad about no Cinderellas, okay. I mean, Arkansas is the lowest-ranked team left. They're ranked 10th.
Yes.
And to see a 10th-ranked team go to the Elite Eight would be cool.
Yes.
That's a good thing. So to me, Cinderellas come with all shoe sizes, if you catch my drift.
Listen to you. Aren't you good?
And lastly, the two most politically reactionary schools, not named Liberty, BYU versus Alabama. Oh, my God. So who do you like in this one, Coach? I mean, does BYU have the goods with all their 25-year-olds who went on Mormon missions, or can Alabama do it?
You said that tongue-in-cheek. That's real. I mean, they're grown men playing against 18, 19-year-old guys. That's an advantage. So yes, they are real. Yes, they can do it. Alabama throws the ball away. They get sloppy with the ball. I actually think BYU is going to win this game, and I will, not a gambling guy, but take the over. You're talking about, I go as high as say, one of these teams will break 100 tonight.
Wow. I'm so excited. So the coach word, everybody, and we're going to call him on this next week, is BYU, Florida, Duke, although that's going to be close, right. And Arkansas. That's the coach word? There we go. Well, Coach, thanks so much for joining me today on Edge of Sports, man. Always a thrill to talk to you, both on camera or off, on radio or off. Always great to get that wisdom coming from Kevin McNutt.
Guys, when the guys aren't here.
Yep. Shout out to Chuck and Etan. Shout out to Juju Watkins. Get well. Shout out to Katia Stitt. For everybody out there listening, especially Magic Mike, please stay frosty. We are out of here.
No, Frosty.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at PlannedGiving@WPFW.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice, and because of your support, we are WPFW.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th, 7 to 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt. Entertainment includes Navasha Deya and more. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
On Sunday, March 30th at 6 p.m. at the National Press Club, the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation presents the Woman of Courage Awards Gala in honor of Mammy Till Mobley, the mother of Emmett Till, celebrating women who exemplify the strength, resilience, and courage of Mammy Till Mobley. Activist ancestor Dory Latner and her sister Joyce are among 18 honorees who embody Mammy Till Mobley's unwavering courage that ignites the civil rights movement and continues to inspire generations today. Details at Eventbrite under Women of Courage Awards Gala. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Jazz lovers, the 15th annual Washington Women in Jazz Festival is back with a weekend of performances, workshops, and jam sessions at the Penn Arts Mansion in Washington, D.C. on March 29th and 30th. From interactive workshops to concerts and late-night jams, there's something for everyone. Details at WashingtonWomenInJazz.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here. You know what that means. Good events, good music, good food, good people, good weather, and the 9th annual Words, Beats, and Life Festival happening April 3rd through the 6th all over Washington, D.C. There will be DJs, concerts, poetry slams, children's activities, and a festival. Details can be found at WBLINC.org/WBLFest.
African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora is featured at the 21st New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 14 to the 27th. The festival features 29 films from 19 countries, discussions with filmmakers, and more.